Welcome to That Was Radio on WMKY, Morehead State Public Radio. I'm Leon Smothers. On this program, we'll look at all aspects of the golden age of radio. Not just the radio programs, though we will look at those, but we'll go behind the mic to consider the personalities and events that inspired and shaped those programs. Along the way, we'll also talk about how the shows were made and about the importance and impact of radio. Over the last decade or so, there's been a resurgence of interest in virtually all things related to the mid-20th century. Just about everywhere you look, someone is selling something retro. We can buy retro automobiles, appliances, and clothing, as well as games and toys. Even vinyl records and typewriters are making a comeback. There's also been a renewal of interest in radio programs from that era. Some of this is just nostalgia, but a younger audience, one that is used to listening to podcasts, is discovering and enjoying old-time radio. And many people who spend a large portion of their time in a car find listening to the old programs preferable to music or talking heads. However, for those who didn't live through the mid-20th century, some things retro can be puzzling. For example, I've heard questions such as, what does hi-fi mean? And why is there a 78 setting on my record player? So to give newcomers a better context for old-time radio, I think it might be helpful to know how it started and how it developed into what was, for a while, America's favorite pastime. Therefore, in this show, I'm going to provide a combination retrospective on radio's beginnings and a sampler of some of the more interesting and influential programs along the way. To begin our journey, let's set the Wayback Machine to December 1901. That's when Marconi sent the first transatlantic radio message. This was just wireless telegraphy at first, and it was used mainly for land, sea, and ship-to-ship communication. Then in 1907, Lee DeForest developed a vacuum tube that was sensitive enough that he was able to broadcast both speech and music to the general public in a portion of New York City. During World War I, the U.S. government took over the development of the vacuum tube to improve wartime communication. So by the end of the war, the technology was adequate to do local broadcasting. But radio was still very crude. Most early radio sets were crystal receivers, often made by wrapping wire around cylindrical oatmeal boxes and using headphones rather than any type of speaker. By the mid-1920s, tuned radio frequency receivers were available, and these provided a major improvement in performance. Of course, for anyone to listen to radio, there had to be something in the air. Some of the first broadcasts were by amateurs from their garages or their basements. Then in November 1920, KDKA in Pittsburgh, the first commercially licensed radio station, made radio history by broadcasting same-day coverage of the presidential election results. This broadcast was heard by an estimated 1,000 people in a three-state area. This generated a lot of public interest because back then, it could take a couple of days to a week to get the results in the local paper. Several other stations began broadcasting in early 1921. By the end of 1922, there were about 30 stations operating. And by the end of 1923, there were more than 500. In the meantime, Westinghouse began producing the first radio receiver for the popular market. It cost $60. That would be about $800 now. In these early years, radio programs mostly duplicated what people could hear in their local theaters, opera, orchestral performances, vaudeville routines, musical reviews, with some news coverage and sports broadcasts interspersed. And most of these early broadcasts were just from recordings. Then in 1922, due to complaints by record companies, President Hoover outlawed the playing of records on the air, so stations began to rely on local musicians and other entertainers. Most of these performers worked for free, just for the publicity. Jim Jordan, of Fibber McGee and Molly fame, said of those days, "You could walk in off the street in any radio station, and they were glad to have you. If you had a ukulele under your arm, you could go to work for nothing." It's interesting that in the early days of radio, there was virtually no advertising. Many stations considered advertising undignified, but as the number of stations grew, there was more competition for listeners. This, in turn, caused stations to create better programming, which meant getting more talented performers, which meant paying more. This upward spiral soon put a financial stress on stations that didn't have adequate backing. Some of the earliest stations that did do advertising were owned by companies that manufactured radios, Westinghouse being a notable example. It seems reasonable, of course, that with better programs, more people would want to buy radios. Other stations were operated by and located in large department stores. For example, in April 1924, Sears Roebuck began experimental broadcasts from a 500-watt station inside their store in Chicago. These few early broadcasts were so enthusiastically received that Sears began permanent broadcasts on April the 12th under the call letters WLS, which stood for World's Largest Store. In addition to radio manufacturers and department stores, other companies began to produce and distribute radio programs under their own names. For example, the Ever-Ready Hour, the Ipana Troubadours, the Palmolive Hour, and the Voice of Firestone. Then, beginning in 1926, some individual radio stations were joined together to form networks. By pooling resources, stations would lessen the financial strain of producing radio shows. The first networks were NBC's Blue Network and Red Network. Then, in 1927, the CBS network was formed. The Quality Network, which formed in 1929, expanded and changed its name to become Mutual Broadcasting System in 1934. Finally, in 1945, after FCC intervention, NBC's Red Network was split off to become the American Broadcasting Company. By the end of the 20s, there were many live performances on radio. Most of the early performers were veterans of vaudeville, and most acts were in the vaudeville style. But the times and the music were changing. I've chosen, as examples, recordings from a couple of popular early radio performers, the Happiness Boys and Rudy Valley. Billy Jones and Ernest Hare called themselves the Happiness Boys because they were sponsored by the Happiness Candy Stores. They first came to radio in 1923 after having made several popular records. In 1928, they were the highest-paid singers on radio. The following clip is fairly representative of a lot of vaudeville acts, which mixed comic banter with musical numbers. I want to assure listeners in advance that no ukulele player was harmed in the making of this recording.
Hey, Bill. Bill, listen to that guy in the next apartment with that ukulele.
I hear him.
Hey, knock on the wall and tell him to stop.
All right. Hey there!
Hey, what do you want? What do you want?
Cut out that practicing, will you?
Anything I do hate is a ukulele.
Yeah, I hate a ukulele, too. Hey, you! I hope you get lumps in your mashed potatoes.
Listen, Bill, I want to tell you something. There's a guy I'll kill someday.
Is it nice to talk that way?
He plays the ukulele.
Well, in that case, it's okay.
He lives in apartment G.
That's the guy that ruins me with his ukulele.
He only knows one melody. It's crazy words, crazy tune.
That's the same thing I hear him croon.
Bo-do-de-o, bo-do-do-de-o-do. Bo-do-do. He sings and plays all night long.
Sings the same words to every song.
Bo-do-de-o, bo-do-do-de-o-do. His ukulele daily, don't he strum?
He's a bum.
Vamping and stamping, crazy words, crazy tune.
He'll be driving me crazy soon
with his bo-do-de-o, bo-do-do-de-o-do.
That was a clip from Crazy Words, Crazy Tunes by the Happiness Boys. This is That Was Radio on WMKY. I'm Leon Smothers. Rudy Valley came to radio along a different path than most. He played saxophone and was a band leader before he began singing. He started performing while in college and later played at nightclubs. He also made several records in the early 20s and began his radio career in 1928. Valley didn't have a great voice, but he was a natural showman, and he knew how to put fun in his performances. And he excelled at molding a program into a comprehensive whole rather than just one number after another. These days, if he's remembered at all, it's usually just for being the first crooner, the musical predecessor of singers such as Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra. But he made a bigger influence in radio by finding and hosting talented entertainers that were destined to be big names in radio. And even more importantly, he was the first to include black musicians on his program. In addition to a long radio career, Rudy Vallee appeared in 33 movies and on Broadway. In this recording of Vagabond Lover, which is kind of his theme song, you get an idea of the style that was becoming the craze of the day. Most of the comedians in the early days of radio were also from vaudeville. But many vaudeville comedians couldn't make the shift to radio. First off, much of their humor involved sight gags, which obviously doesn't transfer to radio. But more importantly, there was the continual need for fresh material. In vaudeville, a comedian could travel with a show from city to city doing the same set of jokes. But with radio, once a nationwide audience heard your routine one week, you couldn't use it again the next. Therefore, the comedians that made the shift were those who were more creative or those who had good writers. Let's consider Ed Wynn. Though he was a big name in vaudeville, Wynn never seemed comfortable on radio. His Texaco Fire Chief program ran a little over 3 years, from April 1932 to June 1935. He was on three other shows in the 30s, but none ran more than a few months. Here's a clip from one of the Fire Chief programs.
Texaco service stations and dealers from coast to coast present the Fire Chief Double Quartet. Don Voorhees and the Fire Chief Band. Graham McNamee. And Ed Wynn, the perfect fool.
Well, I'm the chief again. Tonight, the program's going to be different.
Good evening. Good evening, Chief. I saw you last Sunday out in the country. Yeah. What were you doing carrying that lantern?
Well, it was dark in the country, Graham. I was calling on a girl, so I carried the lantern.
Well, that's funny. When my uncle was carting his wife in the country, he didn't use a lantern.
Oh, I don't doubt that, Graham. But look what he got.
Well, never mind that, Chief. What I want to know is, did you behave yourself,
Sonny? Oh, what do you mean, Graham?
Well, I mean, did you keep the commandment?
Oh, don't be silly, Graham. I always keep the commandment.
You do?
Yes, my great trouble is with the amendment. That's my trouble. Oh, I felt fine when I called on my girl. I felt great, but her father took us on an automobile trip, and I had to be good, Graham.
Did you?
Yes, between his car and the bum roads, it knocked the devil right out of me, Graham.
Well, I finally got you to ride in an automobile anyway, didn't I?
Yes, you did, Graham, but the least you can do for me now is to get on a horse.
Well, Chief, isn't it true that horseback riding gives you a headache?
What are you talking about? Riding a horse give you a headache, Graham?
Yeah.
On the contrary. On the contrary, Graham.
Well,
and what's more, if more people rode horses, there would be less accidents over the weekend.
Oh, still talking in the past, aren't you, Chief? That was before four-wheel brakes.
Oh, Graham, I'm glad you said four-wheel brakes. Well, that reminds me of a beautiful song. I'm going to have Don play it. It's about four-wheel brakes, you know.
Yeah.
The title of it is Four-Wheel Brake, the News to Mother.
Play that, Don.
Any discussion of comedy on radio must include Amos and Andy. Beginning in 1929 and running through 1955, this is one of the earliest and probably the most popular program in the Golden Era. Often considered the first situation comedy, it featured two white men portraying the lives of Southern black men who had moved north and were having trouble dealing with city life, financial problems, personal relationships, and current events in general. To say the program was popular is an understatement. It was an obsession. The program was so popular that theaters moved their start times back and even piped in the broadcasts so customers wouldn't stay home to hear them. President Calvin Coolidge is said to have been such a fan that he refused to be disturbed during the nightly broadcasts. The program was funny and innovative, developing likable characters and complex storylines that were often as suspenseful as they were humorous. However, the program is seldom heard anymore because, especially in the early days, it used racial stereotypes that are socially unacceptable today. The stock market crash of 1929 changed radio as it did almost every aspect of life. Surprisingly, during the Depression, people kept buying radios while the sales of other goods, such as cars, furniture, and appliances, dropped. Through radio, they could get free entertainment and keep up with what was happening in the world at large. But with the mood of the country becoming ever more somber, people wanted programming that either would let them escape from their dismal circumstances or that made them laugh and feel better. Radio responded and flourished. Situation comedies continued to increase in number and quality. Variety shows, such as Rudy Valley's, dedicated larger portions of their programming to comedians and introduced such future comedy stars as Eddie Cantor, Edgar Bergen, Burns and Allen, and Milton Berle. 1931 was a remarkable year for radio. That year, Eddie Cantor began his popular radio run on the Chase and Sanborn Hour. Cantor was a top vaudeville star who had made 7 films and numerous guest appearances on radio by this time. He was known for his bulging eyes and nonstop motion. His program was an instant success and stayed at or near the top of the popularity charts for the rest of the decade. Cantor was a master at milking a joke and was the first to rely heavily on running gags. He especially joked about his 5 daughters. For example, he would joke about trading his daughters for Bing Crosby's 4 sons. In reality, there was no father in Hollywood closer to his daughters than Cantor was. Also making its debut in 1931 was the Burns and Allen program. George Burns and Gracie Allen were one of the funniest comedy teams of all time. George was extremely creative as a comic and was the consummate straight man. Gracie, though very intelligent, was the perfect radio comedian, ditzy and lovable. Let's listen as Gracie visits the psychiatrist.
Now then, Mrs. Burns, just lie down on this couch here and relax completely.
Thank you, Doctor.
First, just a few general questions. How old are you?
I'd rather not say.
Mrs. Burns, I'm a doctor. You can tell me anything. Now, how old are you?
19.
19?
You said I could tell you anything.
I mean, if you tell me your age, I won't let it go any further.
Oh.
Now, how old are you?
19.
Still 19.
I'm not letting it go any further either.
Mrs. Burns, how long have you been married?
15 years.
Then if you're 19 years old, you were married when you were 4.
Oh, Doctor, you've got me trapped. I see I'll have to tell the truth.
Good. Now, how old are you?
20.
Let's skip your age and go on to the next question. Do you have any disturbing dreams, especially dreams that recur again and again?
Oh, yes, yes. Every night for a long time, I dreamed that the Iceman came and put 2 50-pound cakes of ice in the middle of my back.
Very interesting. I must attempt a solution.
Oh, I solved it.
How?
Well, I made George sleep with his socks on.
Yes, I see. Well, now, Mrs. Burns, I'd like to give you a simple little test which will enable me to analyze your thought process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is called a word association test.
Oh, and how does it work?
Well, I will say a word, and that word will suggest something to you. Whatever it is, you say it.
I say whatever I think of.
Right.
Left.
I hadn't started yet. Now, here we go. Picture.
Frame.
Powder.
Pup.
Telephone.
Thank you. Hello?
What does the telephone suggest?
Nothing. Nobody's on the wire.
Mrs. Burns, the telephone did not ring. When I said telephone, you should have said something like Alexander Graham Bell.
I see.
Let's proceed. Army.
Navy.
Soldiers.
Sailors.
Wax.
Fibber, McGee, and Molly.
Wax made you think of Fibber, McGee, and Molly.
They sell it.
I was referring to WACS.
So was I, Johnson's.
Let's proceed. Bing Crosby.
Singing.
Spencer Tracy.
Acting.
Charles Boyer. Charles Boyer.
Oh, no, no. I see you're taking notes.
So?
So my husband can read.
Let's proceed. Hello? Oh, yes, Grace is right here. Telephone.
Alexander Graham Bell.
That was your husband.
No, I'm married to George Burns.
That'll be enough for the word association test.
In 1932, two of radio's all-time favorite comedians, Fred Allen and Jack Benny, went on the air with their own shows. Both were vaudeville veterans. Benny was especially known for his comic timing. On his program, he was always 39 years old and a miser. He was quite a talented violinist and would play on occasion, but always very badly. Fred Allen was known for his topical humor and satire, which was sometimes biting. Throughout his career, he was noted for being as quick with a quip as anyone. While Benny and Allen were actually good friends, their feud is one of the best-known features of the great age of radio.
Well, Jack, this is quite a surprise, you dropping in. I didn't know you were going to be here tonight. I didn't know it either, Fred, until I heard you announce it 5 times last week. But don't get me wrong, Freddie. I appreciate that buildup. I'm one guy who knows that it pays to advertise. Now, listen here, Benny. If that's a hint, you're not getting 1 cent for crawling in here tonight, and you know it. Why, Fred, I didn't expect to get paid for this. I haven't any more right to take money for working on this program than you have. You for a while, eh? Now, those armchair jokes, they'll hold you for a while. Hold on there, Benny. That's an insult. Well, if I was Professor Quiz, I'd say correct. Absolutely correct. And if I was Major Bowes, you'd have left with a unit 10 minutes ago. Hey, that's nice work if you can get it. You know, Freddie, I wouldn't mind being back in vaudeville again, though, would you?
Ah, those were the good old days.
Yes, sir. Say, Fred, no kidding, will you ever forget the time you and I were together at the Orpheum Theater in Sioux City, Iowa?
Yep. Only I was on the stage.
I don't care, Freddie. I made more money selling peanuts in one day than you did all week.
Well, Jack, I didn't make much money in those days, but I was a pretty good juggler. Remember how I used to toss those Indian clubs in the air and do a funny monologue at the same time?
I sure do. And, Fred, you remember when you dropped those clubs? How you'd let them lay there right alongside of your joke?
You ought to know. You swept up the theater every night.
I did not. I used to stay in the theater late just to practice my violin.
Well, you should have stuck to your broom.
Should have stuck to my own program, too. I had to ask for this, Jeffy.
Well, you had to write it, Jeffy.
Well, Fred, anyway, a lot of water has gone over the darn since then, huh?
Over the darn?
Yes, Fred, you know how careful we have to be.
That was a small sample of Jack Benny and Fred Allen's supposed feud. You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY. I'm Leon Smothers. Other than music and comedy, there were two other areas of programming that especially grew during the Depression. One was drama, and the other was what came to be known as soap operas. By the early 1930s, advertising on radio had become both common and diverse. This was an era when few women worked outside of the home. Therefore, one ready-made audience for advertisers was the American housewife. Daytime serials developed as a means of advertising a wide range of household products, but especially soap, detergent, and cleansers, hence the name soap opera. Many of the soaps were written and produced by women, and had storylines that focused on family life, personal relationships, and emotional and moral conflicts. For the women listening, these programs provided companionship and a means of escape. And the women who listened to the soaps were not just passive listeners. Many wrote to their favorite characters and to their sponsors to provide advice and offer comments. And sometimes they would even send gifts. The growth of soap operas was phenomenal. In 1930, there were only a couple of soaps on the air. By 1934, there were 10, and by 1936, there were 31. By 1940, soaps made up 9 out of every 10 sponsored daytime programs. Among the earliest soaps was one called Clara, Lou, and Em, and another called Mert and Marge. And just to show that a man's name could also be used, there was one called Just Plain Bill. Clara, Lou, and Em began in 1930, and is considered by many to be the first soap opera. But it wasn't a typical soap. Rather than melodrama, the show was about 3 young women who lived in a small town duplex and got together once a day to talk. Sometimes they talked about current events. Sometimes they complained about the price of groceries. But mostly they talked about their lives, their hopes and dreams, and of course, their disappointments. In a more traditional soap vein was Mert and Marge, which ran from 1931 to 1947. This program tracked the ups and downs of the title characters with stories that included some unusual twists, kidnappings, organized crime, and murder. The series also injected a degree of comedy into a genre not usually known for wit. The following clip shows just how complex soaps could be even in the 1930s.
Presenting Mert and Marge. Another episode in the thrilling, true-to-life experiences of Mert and Marge, brought to you by the makers of concentrated super suds in the blue box, the new all-purpose soap for laundry and dishes for every household use. Today, Mert and Marge are looking forward to another year, and for the benefit of our new holiday audience, we'd like to give a brief review of the highlights in the life of Mert and Marge. The two girls, you know, are mother and daughter, although you'd never know by looking at Mert that she was old enough to have a grown-up daughter. Since the day that Mert, an experienced trooper, helped the 16-year-old Marge to land her first job in the chorus, the two have known the ups and downs of theatrical life. Today at 38, Mert is the widow of Francis Hayfield, the noted theatrical producer who died last year. Marge at 22 is the wife of Jack Arnold, the lawyer, and the mother of 2-year-old baby Midgie. After varied experiences in Hollywood and the Midwest, our friends have returned to New York City, where Jack Arnold has accepted the post of chief assistant to District Attorney Dunham, and where Mert and Marge hope to reopen the old Hayfields Theater with a production of a new play by Henri Dufay. Jack Arnold has already started a secret investigation of a new racket and has been helped by Marge's old friend, Rex Marvin, a motion picture director who is vacationing in New York. A few days ago, Rex was seized by the racketeers and escaped only after being severely beaten. He's identified one member of the gang from a rogues gallery photograph, and today as our episode opens, we find Jack Arnold and Rex Marvin conferring with District Attorney Dunham.
The other major area of growth in the early Depression was drama. While there was a great deal of diversity in early radio drama, many programs were crime-oriented, such as Eno Crime Club, True Detective, and Sherlock Holmes. These series were not yet as sophisticated as the classic programs of the 40s and 50s, but still, they quickly attracted a large following. The Shadow is not only one of the all-time most popular dramatic radio programs, it also has some of the earliest roots. In the 1930s, Street & Smith was the publisher of several popular magazines. They were looking for a way to promote the sales of Detective Story magazine, so they decided to develop a radio program where each episode was an adaptation of a recent short story from the magazine. The character that was to become the Shadow first appeared in July of 1930 and became the program's narrator. His eerie voice captivated listeners and is instantly recognizable today. The Shadow became so popular to listeners that in 1931, Street & Smith signed William Gibson to write a series of novels featuring the Shadow as a crime-fighting detective. And right he did. Over the next couple of decades, Gibson, writing under the pen name Maxwell Grant, turned out 283 Shadow novels. Through these stories, he created the characters and the world of the Shadow. It took time, though, for the radio program to evolve. It wasn't until September 1937 that the show finally took on the form that has become famous, with Orson Welles and Agnes Moorehead in the starring roles. Several other talented actors provided the voices for these characters during the program's 17-year run.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The Shadow knows.
Your local Blue Coal dealer presents The Shadow. These half-hour dramatizations are designed to forcibly demonstrate to old and young alike that crime does not pay.
The Shadow, mysterious character who aids those in distress and helps the forces of law and order, is in reality Lamont Cranston, wealthy young man about town. Cranston's friend and companion, the lovely Margot Lane, is the only person who knows to whom the unseen voice belongs. The only one who knows the true identity of that master of other people's minds, the Shadow.
Another fertile area for radio drama in the early years of the Depression was the Western. Tales of the Old West had been a mainstay of movies since the earliest silence. So it isn't surprising that they became an early favorite on radio. Three of the earliest on radio will also be familiar to fans of TV westerns. Rin Tin Tin went on the air in April of 1930. By that time, the canine hero had starred in more than 20 movies. The Wonder Dog was moderately successful on radio with a run of 4 years. He would return 20 years later on television, starring in 164 episodes between 1954 and 1959. Death Valley Days, on the other hand, was as popular on radio as it would later be on television. The program began in 1930 and consisted of true, or at least true-ish, stories of the desert Southwest, narrated by the old ranger, who often claimed to have personal knowledge of the story. Death Valley Days was on radio for 15 years, and during this entire period was sponsored by the Pacific Borax Company and its products, 20 Mule Team Borax and Boraxo.
Fiery horse with the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty Hi-Yo Silver, the Lone Ranger.
You're listening to That Was Radio on WMKY. I'm Leon Smothers. On January 31st, 1933, the William Tell Overture introduced for the first time a masked man and his fiery horse with the speed of light. That first broadcast was on WXYZ Radio in Detroit and was carried by the seven stations of the Michigan Radio Network. The Lone Ranger was conceived by George Trendle, who was also part owner of WXYZ. But the person most responsible for the Ranger's development was the writer, Fran Stryker. Stryker, who has been called the best hack writer of all time, turned out 156 episodes a year. Trendle wanted a Western hero who would be a good role model for children. He laid several ground rules for the Ranger from the very beginning. The Ranger was not to have a love interest. He must not smoke or drink or curse. In addition, he never shot to kill. When he had to shoot a bad guy, he did so to injure him as painlessly as possible. This was not, however, just a children's show. It was broadcast in prime time and had a wide and diverse audience. Trendle and Stryker would also collaborate on a couple of other popular radio programs that were fairly similar to The Lone Ranger, The Green Hornet and Challenge of the Yukon. The Lone Ranger is still one of the most popular old-time radio programs.
With his faithful Indian companion Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains, led the fight for law and order in the early West. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Just as advertisers found a ready-made market for women's programming in the daytime, they also recognized that there was a slot after school that was perfect for children's programming. And in the 1930s, where would you find stories that were sure to be of interest to kids? In the comic strips, such shows as Little Orphan Annie, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and Tarzan made the jump from comics to radio in 1931 and 32. A host of other children's shows, some from comics and some created for radio, soon followed. Most of the children's shows were adventure serials broadcast in 15-minute segments on weekday afternoons and on Saturday mornings. Little Orphan Annie was the first to go nationwide and is one of the best known. Her adventures were sponsored by Ovaltine, whose ads touted the product as being delicious and nutritious. However, what really interested kids were the Orphan Annie premiums that you could get by mailing in the seal from an Ovaltine container. Among the goodies offered were photographs, bracelets, buttons, decoder rings, and special mugs. Other children's advertisers followed suit. Soon there were all sorts of premiums available to any children who would eat or drink the product that their favorite radio program touted. If you got one of Annie's decoder badges or rings, you could be a member of Radio Orphan Annie's Secret Society and get a coded message during each episode. As you can hear in this clip, the advertisers often added a bit of product propaganda to help boost sales.
Hi, Eggs and little chatterbox, the one with pretty auburn locks. Whom do you see? It's little orphan Annie. She and Sandy make a pair. They never seem to have a care. Cute little sheep, this little orphan Annie. Bright eyes, cheeks of rosy glow, there's a store of healthiness handy. Might size always on the go, if you want to know. Princess Sandy always wears a sunny smile. Now wouldn't it be worth the while if you could be like little orphan Annie?
Here it is, 5:45 now, and time to hear more about the big new adventure that's starting for Orphan Annie in Simmons Corners. But first, if there are any of you boys and girls who don't like to drink milk, and your mothers scold you because you don't drink enough, don't forget what a wonderful help Ovaltine can be to you. Here's what you do. Instead of drinking your milk plain, ask your mother to let you have Ovaltine after this. Because Ovaltine turns plain milk into the keenest kind of a treat. So chocolatey looking and good, and it tastes even better than it looks. What's more, your mother will be glad to let you have all you want to drink. Because when you add Ovaltine, it greatly increases the food energy value of your milk. Besides that, Ovaltine makes plain milk easier to digest. So you're able to get the good out of all those nourishing food elements in every cupful more easily. Now that's something your mother may not know, so you want to tell her about it right away. Ask her to get you a can of Ovaltine at her drug or grocery store so you can start in drinking it this very night. And boy, you'll get a surprise when you see how good it tastes. And I'll bet your mother will be glad when she sees how many cupfuls you'll want to drink every day. And now, tonight's club night for all you 1936 members of Orphan Annie's Secret Society. And right after tonight's adventure is over, we're going to broadcast another secret message in Annie's Mystery Radio Code. So be sure and keep listening. And say, if you haven't sent in for your 1936 membership yet and are missing out on all the fun of decoding these secret messages that are coming so often from Annie now, don't wait any longer. But get busy and send in right away, especially since it's absolutely free if you're drinking your Ovaltine regularly. Remember, here's all you have to do. Just print your name and address plainly on a piece of paper. Then mail it in together with all of the thin, round aluminum seal from underneath the lid of a can of Ovaltine to Little Orphan Annie, Chicago, Illinois. Or if you live in Canada, mail it to Ovaltine, Peterborough, Ontario. That's all you do. And then Annie will send you the beautiful gold-colored super decoder pin and the new 1936 official secret book that lets you in on all the inside secrets of the club right away. So get busy and send in this very night. And don't forget, be here right on time tomorrow at 5:45 because I have a hunch we're going to see some excitement popping then at the new bridge. Until tomorrow at 5:45, then. Goodbye.
Talent discovery programs such as American Idol are not a recent development. In fact, it wasn't a new format in 1934 when Major Edward Bowes began his original amateur hour. Bowes had been very successful in theater and had the resources to go into radio in a big way. Each week, Bowes would chat with contestants and listen to their performances. Bowes sent the more talented of these contestants on Major Bowes' vaudeville tours. At one time, there were 14 of these troupes touring simultaneously. The radio show soon went to the top of the charts and remained a favorite for years. At its peak, the show received 10,000 applications a week, and producers auditioned more than 500. Major Bowes was so popular that he was made honorary mayor of more than 60 cities, honorary police chief of more than 50, honorary fire chief of 50 more, and honorary editor of 30 newspapers. Among the talented amateurs that would perform on Bowes' show were Frank Sinatra, opera stars Beverly Sills and Lily Pons, and pop singer Teresa Brewer. The program continued until 1945. One of the jewels of the golden era of radio, and still one of the most popular, was Fibber McGee and Molly. The McGees were first heard in 1935 and continued on radio until 1959. Fibber McGee has been variously described as being an incurable windbag, lazy, penny-pinching, and a compulsive liar. Molly was his sweet and long-suffering wife. The couple's radio residence at 79 Wistful Vista was the regular destination of an odd but amusing assortment of folk, including McGee's neighbor Gildersleeve, with whom he was always arguing, Teeny, the little girl who came by to pester him, and Harlow Wilcox, the announcer, generally stopping in to promote Johnson's wax. The show featured a number of running gags, the most famous of which was McGee's cluttered closet. The following clip is from March 5, 1940, and includes the first time the closet gag was used.
The makers of Johnson's Wax and Johnson's Self-Polishing Glow Coat present Marion and Jim Jordan as Fibber McGee and Molly, with Bill Thompson, the King's Men, and Billy Mills Orchestra.
Anything interesting in the paper, dearie?
Well, here's an interesting article on crop surpluses, Molly.
You don't say.
Yeah. Now, take corn, for instance.
Certainly. We can take it and we can dish it out.
Hey, I'm serious. This writer says that if conditions keep up, the small farmer will be completely annihilated.
Oh.
Hey, what's annihilated?
Annihilated. Why, that means, when a farmer, now, for instance,
Where's the dictionary?
It's probably in the closet with the rest of your stuff. Give me your key and I'll get it for you.
Oh, no, you don't. You lay off the stuff in that closet. I got all my stuff arranged in there just the way I want it.
Now, don't be silly. Give me the key.
Okay. Now, let's see. Which one of these is the belongs to...
Heavenly days. Why do you carry all those keys? Does it make you feel important or something?
What do you mean, important? Every one of them keys is necessary.
What's that little key there for?
Well, that's a padlock key.
What padlock?
Oh, for the backyard gate we used to have in Peoria.
What are you keeping that for? Are you homesick?
No, but if we ever move back to Peoria, I'd try to rent the same house because this key fits the padlock there. You got to think ahead in these things. And you see this key here?
Looks like the key to a can of salmon.
Nope, sardines. I use that to clean my pipe with.
Oh, I see.
Now, let's see. Which one of these keys is the closet door key?
Maybe we better see if the closet is locked. Let me take a look.
Oh, it's locked all right. You don't think I'd leave all my personal defects laying around for any prowler to get his hands on?
McGee, it isn't locked. Why, better see your hands, McGee. This stuff's all falling out. Off of me.
All right, but Dad Raddatz, you might have been more careful.
Quick, help! There's funny little insects all over me. Brush them off, quick.
Oh, calm yourself, calm yourself. Them are my trout flies.
Oh.
Doggone it, Molly. Why did you have to go and mess up?
Oh, dear. Come in.
Hi, mister.
Oh, hello there, little girl. What you want?
You remember that job you promised me to take care of your baby, only you didn't have one, so I was going to bring my little brother over and take care of him, remember? Hmm? Do you? Hmm?
Yes, sure, I remember,
Well, the deal is off, see?
What you mean the deal is off? In the first place, there wasn't any deal, and in the second...
Mommy had to take my little brother to the doctor today, so I can't bring him over.
Oh, well, that's too bad. What's the matter with your little brother? Anything serious?
My mama thinks so.
Oh.
She thinks he swallowed a dime.
Swallowed a dime? Well, say, that is serious.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, no, it isn't.
Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, he didn't swallow a dime, I bet you.
Huh?
It was only 8 cents.
Only 8 cents? How do you know?
Well, we were playing slot machine, and I fed him to him.
Near the end of 1936, Rudy Valley introduced a ventriloquist act on his Royal Gelatin program. As you can hear in the following clip, not everyone thought this was a great idea. In fact, it's not clear that Valley was convinced himself.
Why? People have been asking me for the last 2 days, why put a ventriloquist on the air? The answer is, why not? True, our ventriloquist, Edgar Bergen, is an unusual one, sort of Noel Coward or perhaps Fred Allen among ventriloquists. A dexterous fellow who depends more upon the cleverness and wit of his material than upon the believe-it-or-not nature of his delivery. At Elsa Maxwell's most recent Star Spangled Party, the local smart set went smartly mad over Mr. Bergen, and currently he is entertaining the white tie folks at the Rainbow Room. Mr. Bergen works with a dummy, several of them, in fact, but this one is a typical ventriloquist dummy, except that it is arrayed in top hat and tails. Just imagine the dummy, and take my word for it that both voices you will hear are owned and operated by just one man, Edgar Bergen.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. As Rudy told you, my friend here is arrayed in considerable splendor.
Yes, indeed, yes.
And now, young man, I would like to know why you're dressed in tails and top hat and monocle. There must be a story in back of all that.
Oh, there is, stranger?
Yes.
Oh, there is. There's a long story.
I imagine so.
A long story. And a dirty one, too.
I imagine so. Well, where did the money come from?
Oh, the Mazuma.
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you.
I wish you would.
You see, my stepfather...
Yes?
He passed away.
I see.
And when he died, he left me 200 smackers.
Oh, he did. Yeah, I did. Well, I'm sorry to hear about your stepfather.
What's the matter? What did he do now?
No, I mean, passing away.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, yes. Well, what about it?
Well, I mean, it's sad.
Oh, yes. Yes, it was.
Yes.
Yes, it was sad, really.
Yes.
But then, on the other hand, 200 bucks ain't to be sneezed at either.
No, you're right. Well, tell me, is your mother living yet?
No, not yet.
Not yet, no.
Edgar Bergen was accustomed to people being skeptical about his act. He began show business as a teenager when vaudeville was near its peak, and ventriloquist acts were always near the bottom of the bill. He had made his way to the top of the circuit just before vaudeville died. Bergen and his wisecracking dummy made 13 additional appearances on the Valley Show before getting his own show in May of 1937. Charlie was a sarcastic ham, flirtatious wolf, and mischievous schoolboy. The censors allowed Charlie to take his bad boy banter a good deal further than any real person could. Bergen played the perfect straight man, while Charlie got most of the laughs. And the radio audience loved it.
Well, here comes the McCarthy Wrecking Crew in person, and the best way to find out whether America's favorite bad boy is in serious trouble again is to question his pilot and guide. How about it, Edgar? Have you forgiven Charlie for his escapade?
Please, Don, I'd rather not talk about it. I've never been quite so disappointed with any individual in my life as I am with Charlie. Not only did Charlie steal my car and wreck it, Don, but he started a fight with a man he ran into.
Is that true, Charlie?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, yes, Mr. Meacham.
What did you do, Charlie? Huh? And what did you intend to do about that accident? What are you going to do about it?
Oh, the accident?
Yes, yes.
Yes, I know. Seems that I've done enough, don't you think?
Yes, sir. But you know, you'll have to appear in court.
I don't think so, Mr. Bergen.
You don't think so?
No. I see. You see, they took your license number, and it was your car, and so I gave them your name, too. Oh, I see. Why should both of us get mixed up in it?
I see. Well, that's nice. You have the nerve to do that.
Yes.
Charlie, have you no conscience?
Well, yes, I have, Mr. Bergen.
Yes.
Yes, it bothered me so much yesterday, the whole thing. The horrible incident. I decided to go to the police station and confess.
Well, I'm glad to hear that.
Yes.
And did you do it? No, I see.
By the late 1930s, radio had hit its stride. More than 80% of American households had at least one radio. Radio had become so popular that movie producers were using it as a major means of promotion. Programs such as Lux Radio Theater and Screen Guild Theater were drawing big-name movie stars to the microphone. Another indication of the importance of radio can be seen in the financial clout that radio had. In 1937, Jack Benny was paid $400,000. That's what he made just for radio. That year, the President of the United States made $75,000. In sports, Babe Ruth's highest salary was $80,000, which was the most any baseball player would make until 1949. And in Hollywood, Gary Cooper's total income was $370,000, the most for any actor in 1937. If there is still any question about how influential radio was back then, consider the War of the Worlds broadcast. Most people have heard how this program convinced some listeners that Martians had actually invaded, And while it didn't cause the mass hysteria that some alleged, people had such faith in radio that it did result in more than a few anxious phone calls to police, newspaper offices, and radio stations.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have a grave announcement to make. Incredible as it may seem, both the observations of science and the evidence of our eyes lead to the inescapable assumption that those strange beings who landed in the Jersey farmlands tonight are the vanguard of an invading army from the planet Mars. The battle which took place tonight at Grover Mills has ended in one of the most startling defeats ever suffered by an army in modern times. 7,000 men armed with rifles and machine guns pitted against a single fighting machine of the invaders from Mars, crushed and trampled to death under the metal feet of the monster, or burned to cinders by its heat ray. Communication lines are down from Pennsylvania to the Atlantic Ocean. Railroad tracks are torn and service from New York to Philadelphia discontinued, except routing some of the trains through Allerton and Phoenixville. Highways to the north, south, and west are clogged with frantic human traffic. Police and army reserves are unable to control the mad flight. At this time, we take you to Washington for a special broadcast on the national emergency. The Secretary of the Interior.
Citizens of the nation, I shall not try to conceal the gravity of the situation that confronts the country, nor the concern of your government in protecting the lives and property of its people. I wish to impress upon you, private citizens and public officials, all of you, the urgent need of calm and resourceful action.
So by 1940, radio was the major communication medium in America, and it was drawing top talent to create and perform high-quality programs. The golden age of radio was underway. The Great Depression was beginning to end, and it seemed that good times were just ahead. Yet, the shadow of war was on the horizon. But that's another story for another time. You've been listening to That Was Radio, where we discuss old-time radio programs and the people and events that inspired and shaped them. I'm Leon Smothers, and this is Morehead State Public Radio.